نحن الآن نمر يعني قادمين على.
We are about to enter the seventh year since the start of the aggression against our country, which has greatly affected the humanitarian situation, especially for children, who are the most affected segment in all aspects of life, such as health, education, social, and other aspects, and they have lost all the rights guaranteed by international human rights law.
The numbers of affected children continue to grow each day. 2.1 million children are acutely malnourished and 358,000 severely malnourished, meaning that some children are already suffering under famine-like conditions. Meanwhile, Yemen's Ministry of Health held a press conference to shed more light on the dire conditions of children in the country.
What the children of Yemen suffer as a result of the Saudi aggression and blockade since March 2015 is a real humanitarian catastrophe by all international standards. More than 2,400,000 children are deprived of education, and more than 3 million children are homeless. Malnutrition, which is spreading among children, has been condemned by international organizations and is said to be the result of not getting enough food.
Saudi Arabia has committed countless atrocities against children in Yemen, where children are also targeted by airstrikes. The air attacks have killed thousands of children and left thousands more suffering from disabilities, not to mention travel restrictions on thousands of patients, including children who need to travel for treatment.
As the world is silently watching an entire people being deprived of the basics of life, Yemen has become the most dangerous place in the world for children to grow up, according to UNICEF. Abdul Latif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
The Knesset, the Israeli parliament, dissolved itself and the unity cabinet collapsed, pushing the Israelis into yet another early election on 23rd of March that would be the fourth in 2 years. The Knesset dispersed after failing to meet the legal deadline for approving a budget for 2020. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu of the conservative Likud party had refused to present a budget in violation of his coalition agreement with his main rival turned partner Benny Gantz of the centrist Blue and White party.
The dissolving of the Knesset was simply because of Netanyahu's unwillingness to give up the premiership. The very possible scenario is the return of another political impasse for Israel. So Netanyahu will not be able to form a coalition that's satisfying and acceptable for all parties. We may even witness a fifth election after the upcoming vote.
Experts, however, say the dissolving of the Knesset would have been more advantageous for Netanyahu. It's not only a deep distrust between Netanyahu and Gantz. Netanyahu was gambling on another election in the hope of forming a right-wing religious cabinet that would grant him some kind of immunity from prosecution. Netanyahu's corruption trial is scheduled to move into an intensive evidentiary stage in early 2021, requiring his regular presence in court. The current cabinet will remain in place in a caretaker capacity until after the election, and the formation of a new cabinet is a process that could take many months. However, the Israelis are convinced that there isn't any guarantee that the fourth election would finally end Israel's internal dogged stalemate. According to observers, Netanyahu has triggered early elections in an attempt to stay in power beyond his current term. However, they add that Netanyahu's fight for re-election is a difficult battle, mainly as his corruption trial is scheduled to resume with witness testimony next February. Mona Kandib, Occupy, Ramallah.
Every year ahead of Christmas, this street in downtown Tehran gets packed with Christian residents in the capital, a rush to buy last-minute items to celebrate the birth of Jesus. This year, however, the hustle and bustle is gone, as the coronavirus pandemic has emptied the streets and pushed people into their homes. Many families cannot celebrate the festive season together. But Christians here say this does not mean they should abandon the celebrations when they can do it online.
Happy New Year and Merry Christmas to all. This year we miss all the family gatherings, but it's all right. We can catch up with each other using video calls. I hope that in the new year, the pandemic will be gone.
Merry Christmas to all Iran and all the world. And in spite of that we have this pandemic time, I wish everybody will have very soon good times, and 2021 will be happy for every of us.
Nearly 120,000 Christians live in Iran. The majority of them are Armenians, who follow the Oriental Orthodox branch of Christianity. While they make up less than 1% of the Iranian population, they feel at home when it comes to Christmas.
You know, the Christmas.
Merry Christmas. It's good to see the Christmas atmosphere running deep here in Iran, where the majority are Muslims. We feel at home here.
Iran has for the past month been under nationwide lockdown to contain the resurging virus. This has curtailed religious ceremonies across the red zones in the country, and church rituals are no exception.
While 2020 was not a happy year, Christians here say it taught humanity a great lesson, to value even the shortest moments with their loved ones. Knowing this year's Christmas, Happy New Year is more than just a wish, and everyone is praying that in 2021, the coronavirus will be a thing of the past. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Karina was a working mom with a job in the tourism sector, decimated by the pandemic. With no savings to fall back on, and with her husband's delivery job earnings nowhere near enough for them to get by, they ended up in a position no one wants to find themselves.
I never knew about food bank. I just found out since I was on a financial difficulty.
Karina's quest for help led her to Educare Family Support Service, one of many publicly funded companies helping families down on their luck in the age of COVID.
We have lots of different food items that will go in. The plan behind it was that we would be able to prepare hampers for families, who disadvantaged families who may not be able to afford to have a Christmas meal or Boxing Day meal. So we've ensured that we've provided a hamper with everything excluding the meat. At the moment, we're on about 270. Literally, that is 270 families.
270 of many more families facing food insecurity and hunger, exacerbated by the pandemic, a situation that's drawn in UNICEF for the first time in its 70-year history in this country.
In these unprecedented times, I would imagine that these families have become known to their professionals that they're engaging with and are now require additional support.
This cavernous space is the interior of an Anglican church in West London. In normal times, it would see worshippers kneeling in prayer. Today, it's dedicated to something more pressing, getting food into people's cupboards.
I've got quite emotional, actually, about, you know, just the thought that you're privileged and get to enjoy Christmas and then other people are going without, especially at the moment with these troubled times. So I thought if I can come and make just a little bit of difference.
These hampers are being stuffed with supplies to last families for a few days. People used to go to food banks to pick them up. Since the onset of COVID, the whole project of compassion has taken on a new dimension, deliveries.
These volunteer drivers will be dropping off food and presents at hundreds of households for the next 3 days. A drop in the bucket considering the number of families depending on these supplies. And some of those families have up to 6 children.
Most of these volunteers found out about this project on social media. Some of them have dedicated their only day off to being here.
To see the family smiles and the people who need the things is, you know, I can't explain what you feel. The smile of them faces just can give me the energy. They can make my day.
Some have brought their young ones along so they can see firsthand what their less fortunate peers are going through. Those with bigger vehicles have come as couples to help transport more of this humanitarian assistance to homes where kitchen cabinets are not restocked as often as they should.
It's nothing for me to offer a couple of hours, so we are also in a position where it could be me who needs this support.
This year has been very contrasting in the fact that there's some people just getting richer and richer and richer, and we're reaching rock bottom, really, and in sense of community is getting destroyed, really.
If you're feeding a family of 4 to 6 people, that's going to last
yeah, 2 days. It will get them through till Christmas Eve, hopefully.
And we all think we're struggling. Karina has had to adapt to her new world, caring for her 3-year-old daughter in a small rented apartment with no garden while her husband works, and looking after her ailing father who lives on his own.
I know a lot of people are suffering during this difficult time. It's very challenging, but you have to be positive at all times. Seek for help. If you don't ask, you don't get it.
Karina is perhaps one of the tens of thousands of families, if not more, for whom survival depends on charitable donations. Saeed Fariza, London.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
This is a part of a speech delivered on October 12, 2020 by Ayatollah Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, via video conference with the participants at the joint graduation ceremony held at the Imam Ali Military Academy.
New military threats are taking shape. This is because threats are constantly changing. Therefore, our military academies should plan for confronting new threats. This should be taken into account in the research conducted by academies. They should have plans for confronting the threats. Besides, they should be able to predict the new threats. For example, today there are cyberspace threats, but they did not used to exist like this 10 years ago, and they might be transformed in a few years. Therefore, our intelligent experts should engage in predicting them by benefiting from collective thinking and from academic research. This should form an important part of our academy's activities, and academies should come up with important ideas in this regard. The next point is that our armed forces have gained valuable experiences during and even after the sacred defense era.
Your light and love, all I see, nothing more I'd ever want to need. My Lord, protect me from dishonor, grant me faith to be stronger.
Some of the military tactics employed during the sacred defense era were really unprecedented in the world, and many of our operations have guaranteed the existence of valuable experience. We can mention Thamin al-A'immah, greetings be upon him, Fathul Mubin, Baytul Muqaddas, Khaybar, Wal-Fajr 8, Karbala 5, and other such operations. Many extraordinary achievements were made in those victorious operations. Even in the operations in which we did not achieve victory, such as operations Karbala 5, Ramadan, and the like, there are valuable experiences. Therefore, we should benefit from them. Today, mentioning these experiences is common practice in our academies, and this is very good, but it is not enough. These experiences should turn into theories. Experiences should turn into defensive theories, and then be taught and researched. They should become up to date so that they conform to present day needs and so that we can benefit from them, God willing. These are very valuable assets which should be developed and benefited from.
This is the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily, round the clock, for listeners across the globe. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via the internet, shortwave, medium wave, FM, and satellites. Our listeners in the Indian subcontinent can listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 41 meters, 7,300 kilohertz every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to the English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 49 meters, 6,040 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa via shortwave 25 meters, 11,880 kilohertz every day from 1920 to 2020. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our programs via FM 91.5 MHz. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or Bat 5 and via the Internet. Our Internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, P.O. Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, who allowed none to witness when He created the heavens and the earth, and who took no helper when He authored the spirits. He has no associate in divinity and no support in unity. Tongues fall silent before the limits of describing Him. Intellects fail before the core of knowing Him. Terrors fall low in awe of Him. Faces are humbled in fear of Him. And everything mighty yields to His mightiness. so to thee belongs praise again and again, well measured, continually and methodically. And may his blessings be upon his messenger endlessly, and his salutation everlastingly, eternally. O Allah, make the beginning of this day of mine righteousness, its middle prosperity, and its end success. I seek refuge in thee from a day whose beginning is fright, and whose middle is anxiety, and whose end is pain. O Allah, I pray forgiveness from thee for every vow I have vowed, and every promise I have promised, and every pledge I have pledged, then failed to keep for thee. I ask thee concerning the complaints of thy servants against me. If there is a servant from among thy servants, of a handmaid from among thy handmaids, who has against me a complaint, because I have wronged him in respect to himself, his reputation, his property, his wife or his child, or because evil words I have spoken about him in his absence, an imposition upon him through inclination, caprice, scorn, zeal, false show, bigotry, whether he be absent or present, alive or dead, such that my hand has fallen short and my capacity has been too narrow to make restitution to him or to annul my obligation to him, I ask thee, O he who owns all objects of need which are granted by his will and hastened to his desire, that thou blessest Muhammad and the household of Muhammad, peace be upon them, and makest the one I have wronged satisfied with me in the manner that thou willst, and givest me mercy from thee. Forgiveness decreases thee not, and giving injuries thee not. O most merciful of the merciful, O Allah, give me on every Monday two favors from thee: the facility to obey thee at its beginning, and the favor of thy forgiveness at its end. O he who is Allah, and none other than whom grants forgiveness for sin.
The debate.
Hello and welcome to Debate. I'm Marzia Hashimi. Thanks so much for being with us. Well, the Palestine policy is our red line. According to Turkey's President Recep Tayyip Erdogan, this is what the Turkish premier has said when talking about improving ties with Israel. Now, there are questions as to why Turkey has chosen this time to talk about improving ties with Tel Aviv. One may ask, has Israeli aggression stopped toward Palestinians? Or have Israelis removed themselves from internationally recognized occupied territories? Or have illegal settlements increased that Erdogan wants better ties? So what exactly is going on here? Well, stay with us as we take a look at another decision by Erdogan, which is turning a lot of heads. I'd like to welcome my guests to the program. We're going to start it all off, though, in Ramallah with Mona Kandil. Mona, fill us in on what's being said over there about why at this time the Palestinians may think that Erdogan wants to get closer to Israel?
First of all, there hasn't been any official response from the Palestinian Authority on these news. However, Palestinians, normal Palestinian people, would of course reject any relations between any country with Israel that they consider it's their enemy, and Israel is occupying the Palestinian lands. But the experts were guessing that maybe Erdogan is trying to have this good relations with the coming U.S. administration, and that in a way or another, he's trying to make the ties with Israel better. He said that the Palestine policy is a red line for Turkey, and at the same time, he said that the Israeli policies towards the Palestinians is unacceptable. But for the Palestinian people, this is, of course, not enough, because there were reports saying at the time some Arab countries were signing reconciliation and normalization of ties with Israel, that Tayyip Erdogan appointed a new envoy to Israel, because in 2018, Turkey pulled back its envoy to Israel.
Okay, thanks so much for that update, Mona. Let me welcome my guest, Arin Berg, from the Scottish Palestine Solidarity Campaign, Mick Napier. Mick, thanks so much for being with us. Mick, your take on all this. What do you think is going on? Why now? Why do you think that Erdogan says he wants these warmer ties at this point in time?
Well, I'm not privy to the inner councils of the Turkish government, of course, but it's a very complex situation. On the one hand, almost the founding of the State of Israel, Turkey had a very strong strategic military relationship Turkey had a very close strategic relationship with Israel, and that lasted through thick and thin up until Erdogan's party began to rise in 2002-2003. So relations have always been very close, and even though there are political spats, so for example, when the Israelis murdered 10 Turkish citizens who were trying to challenge the siege of Gaza, all during that time, economic relations have been very close and have not really been challenged. And the Palestinian call for boycott of the State of Israel has completely been ignored by Turkey. The situation is complicated because Erdogan obviously has regional ambitions. He wants to present himself as a leader of the Muslim world. In order to do that, the Palestinian issue is obviously central, and normalizing with Israel and being seen to throw the Palestinians under the bus, as the UAE has done, as Morocco has done, and as Saudi is possibly preparing to do, would really run counter to those ambitions. So he has to tread a very difficult path. On the one hand, to try to present himself as a champion of Palestinian rights, but on the other hand, he's maneuvering with, so for example, Greece and Cyprus have a very close relationship to Israel. They train together militarily. And against that axis, it seems to me that Erdogan is trying to re-establish links with Biden, which were very damaged under Trump, when he seemed to tilt a little bit towards Russia by buying Russian arms, which jeopardizes relations with NATO. Maybe he's trying to repair those links, and he, like the Gulf regimes, thinks that Israel is the royal road to Washington.
Well, thanks so much. Let me cross over to London and welcome Editor-in-Chief of the International Interests, Sami Hamdi. Thanks so much for being with us. Your take on all of this? You just heard our guest Mick there say basically perhaps it's a way to warm up to Biden. So the question would be, is that many say that the Trump administration has put pressure on many Muslim countries to try to make sure that they either establish ties or increase their ties with Israel. So what I want to ask you basically is how do you see Biden fitting in all of this? Do you think that it is the U.S. that is putting pressure on Turkey, or is it Erdogan acting independently?
I think it's important to note that Erdogan has the benefit of having inherited ties with Israel as opposed to establishing them. He inherited a legacy whereby Turkey, the first Muslim-majority country to recognize Israel in the 1940s. Mm-hmm. In other words, whereas Erdogan has always claimed that he is pro-Palestine, but despite not rolling back those relations, he has always been content with that. He has not sought to improve those relations or improve those particular ties. And we've seen that since Erdogan has been president, ties between Turkey and Israel have deteriorated rapidly until eventually the withdrawal of the ambassador in 2018. However, it's important to differentiate between words and actions. While Erdogan, personally, I believe that he genuinely has a distaste for Israel, while I believe that he genuinely has deep sympathies for the Palestinian causes, I think Erdogan is well aware what it means to go up against Israel. And that's why, despite the public rhetoric, despite the deterioration in diplomatic relations, we saw them cooperate with one another in Azerbaijan. We've seen Turkish Airlines, it flies to Tel Aviv, no problem with that whatsoever. We've seen Turkish advisors often come out and talk about the romantic possibilities of how great relations can be between Turkey and Israel. Even if Erdogan doesn't say it through his own mouth, he sends his advisors to say it, wary of balancing between this image as a sultan of the Muslim world and this image of a pragmatic nationalist Turkish leader. I think when it comes to this recent statement that came from Erdogan's own mouth, which is very unusual when it comes to issues related to Israel, I think it has entirely to do with Biden. It has entirely to do with the economy. But more important than that, it has to do with the Turks. I don't believe that Israel can offer anything to Erdogan in terms of foreign policy. Turkey is very strong in the East Med. It's strong in Libya. It's strong in Syria. It's strong in Azerbaijan. It's wrestling with Russia and doing very well at wrestling. But the Turks domestically are becoming increasingly tired at the economic cost, at the sanctions that were imposed, at the deteriorating lira, at the plummeting economy. And Erdogan is very concerned that Biden is going to be increasing that pressure with the prospect of sanctions, with the prospect of antagonism. And therefore, Erdogan wants to insulate this economy in his economy in the only way he knows how, particularly given that the elections are coming up soon, by relying on Israel in the same way that the UAE, Qatar, Saudi, Morocco, and the others have relied on Israel to open the door to the White House to say, look, let's talk, let's sit down, but okay, please don't let Biden go after my economy. And this is why I think that we see the statement coming from Erdogan. It's not about foreign policy. It's not about his love for Israel. The tragedy is that he is now leaning on Israel to get some economic benefit so that he can win over the Turks, win over his own people, so that he can win the elections.
Okay.
That's the tragedy, to rely on the occupier to please the Muslims.
What do you think about that, Mick? You heard what Sami said. I mean, he said basically to bring his own people on board. But if we look at the Turkish nation in general, one would think that the majority of them are actually pro-Palestinian, pro-Palestinian cause. But I want your take on what Sami has just said. Do you think that the Turkish government is thinking in that way, that it's going to take actually ties with Israel or improving ties with Israel in order to help its own economy?
Well, yes. I mean, Sami's expanded in a much more sophisticated way than what I said earlier, that this is to do with trying to beat a path to Biden, trying to improve relations with Israel, and the Palestinians have nothing much to offer the Turkish government at the moment. The problem is, the Mavi Marmara went quite deep into the body politic, and when Israel killed 10 Turkish citizens, it was very difficult for the Turkish government to push that to one side, and the behaviour of Israel ever since then has forced Erdogan to seem to be very hostile to Israel. Not just at the Davos Forum where he stood up and made a blistering verbal attack on Israel. Not just in various other fora where he's been verbally very critical, but he has to try to conciliate public opinion. He has to ride the tiger of public opinion on the one hand and try to achieve what Sami has said on the other. Get the trade enhanced with Israel, to see off the threat of sanctions from Joe Biden, who is no less of a cold warrior than Donald Trump was, possibly even more. So Erdogan's in a very difficult situation. The fact is that Israel has been cultivating governments in the region, not just in the Gulf, but very, very firmly the Greek government and the Cypriot government. And Erdogan is in fierce competition with these two in the Eastern Mediterranean. He needs all the allies he can get. At the very least, if he can neutralize Israel in his effort to access hydrocarbons in the Eastern Med, this will be a strategic calculation as well. But yes, it's another government lining up to beat a path to Washington, to normalize relations with Israel, and actually the Palestinians don't have any counter pressure, except that of popularity with Turkish public opinion, and Erdogan thinks he can marginalize that.
Well, Sami, your take, what you said as far as helping with domestic issues, why is it that we see more and more Muslim countries actually turning towards Israel instead of trying to expand cooperation with each other, for example, with Turkey and the region it is in? Of course, there's hostilities right now between Turkey and Syria. But if it tried to go in the other direction and try to expand ties in its own region and strengthen ties in its own region, couldn't that help it economically instead of turning to the occupier of Palestinian land?
I think that it's important to highlight that while the Turks sympathize with the Palestinian cause, it's important to understand that Turkish foreign policy is heavily nationalist and not necessarily Islamist in the way that perhaps Erdogan presents himself. While we hear Islamist rhetoric, the unfortunate reality is, that Erdogan has only ever been able to garner public support for his foreign policy when he has presented it in a nationalist lens, whether that's Azerbaijan, two states, one people, two states, whether that's in Libya, interest of the Eastern Mediterranean, whether that's Syria, PKK and YPG, as opposed to this wider ideal that he often preaches about one community, one Muslim world. I think the direct answer to your question leans on this, in that Turkey has always had to balance between this nationalism that Ataturk used to withdraw Turkey from the Muslim world and versus Erdogan's deeply held personal beliefs about bringing Turkey back to the Islamic world. While Erdogan believes in the latter, the Turks are still stuck in the former. And that's why we see that when it comes to elections, the closer we get, the more nationalist Erdogan becomes in his rhetoric, in his policies. And this is why when we look at what's going on in the region, Turkey's relations with Saudi and with the UAE and the like, the reality is that the relations are still very self-interested, both on the Turkish part and on the Arab part. The second issue, and it's important to highlight this very fundamental issue, is this reliance not necessarily on Israel, but on United States power. When Qatar wants to pursue an independent foreign policy, between quotation marks, it hands a third of its land to the U.S. to establish a Udaid military base that it points towards Saudi, that it points towards its other neighbors to pursue an independent foreign policy. The UAE, in order to assert its independent foreign policy, again between quotation marks, it brings a U.S. military base. Saudi, to assert independence against Qatar and against the UAE, who are pointing these bases, brings its own U.S. military base. In other words, each one starts pointing towards the other by bringing external power that plays them off one another in terms of extracting billions of dollars in investment and the like, to ensure that there is never really any effective unity. And I think we've seen that bids to unite the powers, whether that's the Saudi Arabia ambition or initiative in the 1990s, whether that's the initiative of the North African countries, the reality is that the U.S. always manages to get one of these smaller countries in order to act up. They bring the American military base and they scupper those sorts of initiative. And that's why I think the reality is that it's not necessarily can these countries take agency for themselves. The reality is you have to remember this is a region where there is a very powerful hegemonic power called the United States of America, with extensive military bases, that has assassinated leaders that have fallen out of line, that has gone to war with countries with made-up UN resolutions and with initiatives with declarations against people that it doesn't like, that has exacerbated ideas of terrorism and the like in order to establish hegemony in the region. It's not easy to go rogue. It's not easy to go independent. And I think these harsh realities are what ensure that this status quo continues in the way that it is.
Okay, well, Nick, now Erdogan says he wants to cooperate with Israel, especially in intelligence. What do you think exactly that means? Because we've seen Israeli intelligence attempt to destabilize the region, as well as be involved in many assassination terrorist acts. So what does that mean when he says he's looking at perhaps cooperating with the intelligence with Israel?
Well, I think he says that the intelligence the groups are currently working closely together, and I think that is the case. See, I think the difference between the Gulf monarchies like the UAE, Qatar, and Saudi Arabia is that they are inherently unstable. They're hydrocarbon extraction states with very little other resources to base themselves on. Their elites rely upon the United States almost for their existence. Israel also, in a very different way, because it's constantly in tension or at war with the whole area, it also relies on the link, the military and the financial link, the air bridge of arms and finance between Washington and Israel, almost relies on that to continue in its present form. I think Turkey and to a lesser extent Egypt are a little bit different. They've got very large populations. They don't rely substantially on oil and gas, and certainly Turkey has ambitions throughout the whole region, which it can promote. It doesn't rely on the USA to quite the same extent, and we've seen that recently with its tilt towards Moscow, with the buying of the S-400 air defense system, and real anger, fury in the Pentagon and right across the whole of NATO, and Turkey was able to maintain that position. But now it seems to be tilting towards Washington. Mm-hmm. But I don't think it's quite under American domination in the same way that the Gulf regimes are. It's got more freedom for maneuver. So it's a tilt. It's certainly prepared to throw the Palestinians under the bus in the same way that the Gulf monarchies have done. But that's in pursuit of its own regional hegemony. I mean, and towards that end, Turkey has a record of cooperating with Israel against, for example, Iran. Mm-hmm. Ministers have met together. Erdogan actually made a visit to Israel, I think it was in 2007, around the time where an Israeli minister said their relations were perfect. And Erdogan said, yes, well, Iranian nuclear ambitions are a threat towards the whole region. Absolutely silent on Israel's possession of arsenals of mass destruction.
Okay.
So I think Turkey has more room for maneuver. It's quite prepared to ally with Israel against other challenges in the region. And at the moment, it seems to be seeking favor with Biden, seeing the opportunity of Trump's disappearance.
Okay. Well, Sami, looking at this whole situation and what's going on, and if Turkey is going to increase its relations with Israel, what does it all mean for the Palestinians themselves and the Palestinian cause? How do you see that being affected?
I think the Palestinian cause is in dire straits. It's been in dire straits for some time. The reality is that it is true that Erdogan gave some hope for the Palestinians and the Muslim world with his rhetoric, with the idea of Turkey becoming a power, with Turkey asserting itself in Syria and Libya and the East Med, with Turkey sitting on the same table as Russia and the US. I think many Palestinians hope that that would be reflected in perhaps drones being given to the Palestinians, the Bayraktar drones, whether it's increased support, isolation of Israel, whether it's leading some movement towards pressuring Israel. But instead, they're seeing the opposite. They're seeing that not only are the UAE and Morocco normalizing ties, but that Erdogan is leaning on this narrative of, I'm not the one who normalized ties, but given we already have them, I'm not going to reverse them, and I'm going to go back to Israel and improve my ties and improve relations. Again, not necessarily because Erdogan likes Israel, but because he needs them. So I think the Palestinians will look in the sense that Erdogan lifted our hopes for the past 10 years, and suddenly they've been dashed, as he's expressed this weakness that perhaps wasn't expressed beforehand. But I do think the reality is that for the Palestinians, I think all of this is a learning curve, in that the reality is that resistance has to come from the Palestinians. It has to come from a unified effort by the Palestinians. They have to take it for themselves, because the reality is that nations often pursue these policies in self-interest. As an Algerian myself, we know that the War of Independence began by Algerians inside Algeria without international support, albeit some from Nasser, some from, but they had to take the initiative themselves within Algeria before they managed to cause this snowball effect. I think the Palestinians, Fatah and Hamas, this division between them, doesn't help their cause. I think they have to unite, they have to find some sort of bloc, and they have to stop relying in the manner that Mahmoud Abbas is doing on the Saudis, on the UAE and the like, who force him to swallow these normalization like a bitter pill, because he has no other options available to him. There needs to be greater agency for the Palestinians, and I think the complacency that has settled in over the past decade amongst the Palestinians, I think what's happening with normalization, with Erdogan and the like, is a welcome wake-up call in reminding the Palestinians that they have to fight for their freedom, they must fight for their liberation, and this idea that it is impossible or that they rely on others is not going to benefit them.
All right. Thank you both for being with us. We're out of time in this program. Scottish-Palestine Solidarity Campaign member Mika Napier out of Edinburgh and Editor-in-Chief of the International Interest, Sami Hamdi, out of London. I appreciate both of you being with us. And as always, we appreciate you being with us on Another Debate. I'm Marzia Hashimi. Hope to see you right here same time tomorrow.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
The Iraqis are again decrying the rampant injustice in the U.S., and as admitted by the New York-based Human Rights Watch, Trump's pardons show contempt for the rule of law. Dear listeners, this was part of an article written by the staff of Kayhan International. This article is published under the heading Iraqis owe not to trust the U.S. anymore after Trump's latest crime. Stay tuned for the details of this article, please. Reports from Iraq and from elsewhere around the world speak of shock and surprise at the pardoning of convicted murderers serving their sentences by a super criminal still at large. But for Iranians and the Islamic Republic of Iran, it was not a matter of surprise, since terrorism is ingrained in the satanic nature of the U.S. administration. Although the ghastly massacre at Baghdad's Nisr Square was not during his presidency, nor did the murderers of the murderous Blackwater Agency start their jail terms, ranging from 30 years to life. After his election in late November 2016, Donald Trump, in his dying moments in the White House, took another devilish step to pardon the unpardonable killers. On September 16, 2007, Paul Slough, Yvonne Liberty, Dustin Hurd, and Nicholas Sladen had opened fire indiscriminately with machine guns and grenade launchers on a crowd of unarmed people at a roundabout in Iraqi capital, killing 14 men, women, and a child on the spot, and leaving 17 others injured. After a belated trial, the four were convicted of first-degree murder in 2014, but instead of being executed, they began their prison terms in 2015. Full 8 years of undeserving freedom, while the bereaved families who are still in the state of agony at the slaughter of their loved ones lamented the lack of justice in the United States of America. The Iraqis are again decrying the rampant injustice in the United States. And as admitted by the New York-based Human Rights Watch, Trump's pardons show contempt for the rule of law. A survivor of the Nisr massacre rightly remarked that the person who releases these criminals is more of a criminal. But he erred when he added that the Iraqi government should ask the incoming Joe Biden administration to revoke the pardon. Unfortunately, such statements show the naivety of the victims of the great Satan, who, despite their shabby treatment time and again by the U.S., still think that the next administration in the White House will somehow reverse the policies of the previous one and grant them some reprieve. Such an attitude is nothing but sheer moral, intellectual, political, and spiritual bankruptcy, which certainly makes the U.S. more insolent and arrogant in its further mistreatment of the victims, and an opportunity to extract more concessions from them while imposing more stringent conditions. For the Americans, the blood of the Iraqis, or for that matter, of all other people, is cheaper than water, and there is no reason for Washington not to tighten its tentacles when the opposite side is willing to put its neck under the Yankee yoke. True, FBI investigators who visited the scene in the days following the Nisr massacre had described it as the My Lai Massacre of Iraq, a reference to the infamous slaughter of the civilian villagers by U.S. troops during the Vietnam War, for which only one troop was convicted. But the victims of American aggression owe not to be deceived by such meaningless statements. If the Americans are sincere, then they should hand over the criminals to the Iraqi people or government to punish them as per Iraqi laws, since the crime took place on the Iraqi soil and the victims were the Iraqi people. Over the past 42 years of the Islamic Republic of Iran has shown to the whole world that on no account should the U.S. be trusted, as became crystal clear after Washington's unilateral breach of the Seven-Nation International Accord of Geneva 2015 on Iran's nuclear rights. There is no remorse on the part of the U.S., neither concerning the JCPOA with Iran, nor the continued occupation of Iraq, where despite the legislature's unanimous decision to close down the American military bases, the executive continues to hesitate in showing the exit door for unexplained reasons. knows how many Blackwater criminals still linger in U.S. bases or the embassy in Baghdad, albeit under different names and designations, when the U.S. has no inhibitions in setting up an American-led mercenary army in the UAE that has since reportedly been deployed in Yemen, and of all people under supervision of the notorious Eric Prince, the founder of the now supposedly dissolved Blackwater. So don't trust the Americans and ask them to leave without delay before the criminal Trump commits another act of terrorism on Iraqi soil. And moreover, no change of guard in the White House will redress the sufferings of the Iraqi people.
IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website www.parstoday.com/en.